Oyez, 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 the Honorable Court of Appeals for the Third District, State of Texas, City of Austin, is now in session.
Thank you, you can all be seated. Hello, my name is Shari Kelly, and along with my colleagues, Justice Rosa Theofanis and Justice Karen Crump, we welcome you to the Texas Third Court of Appeals. Today's proceedings are being broadcast live on our YouTube channel, and that recording will be available later on the YouTube channel, and an audio recording of today's argument will also be available on our webpage for the Third Court of Appeals. We'll hear argument this afternoon in case number 03210035CV, Hensley versus State Commission on Judicial Conduct. Counsel for each side, please state your appearance by giving us your name and your clients' names.
Your Honors, I'm Douglas Lang. I represent the Commission and named defendants individual commissions.
Counsel for appellant, you're reserving 5 minutes for rebuttal, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And for both of you, please be aware that when the yellow light comes on, you have 2 minutes left, and when the red light comes on, your time is up. And note that our amplification system, we don't have an amplification system, so the mics are for recording, but they're not making anything louder, so just be careful to make sure that you speak loud enough so we'll be able to hear you. And if you can't hear one of our questions, please ask us to repeat the question. And with that, counsel for appellees, you have 20 minutes, and counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm going, this is my first time presiding. I apologize, I flipped ahead of my script. So, counsel for appellant, when you're ready, you can proceed with your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. The Supreme Court of Texas remanded this case after rejecting most of the commission's immunity arguments, as well as its failure to exhaust defense. There are now 4 discrete issues remaining for this court to address and resolve. The first is whether Judge Hensley's claims for declaratory and injunctive relief have become moot on account of the state Supreme Court's decision, as well as the commission's decision to unilaterally withdraw the public warning that it had imposed on Judge Hensley in November of 2019. Second issue for this court is whether the district court erred in holding that Judge Hensley's claims were unripe and that she was seeking an advisory opinion. That was an issue that was resolved as part of the plea to the jurisdiction, but the state Supreme Court did not weigh in on that part of our proceeding in that court. The third is whether the district court erred in granting the commission's plea in estoppel. So this was the res judicata and collateral estoppel defenses the commission had raised. The district court accepted those defenses, but the state Supreme Court did not rule on them. So they are still in the case for this court to decide. And the fourth and final issue is whether the district court should have granted Judge Hensley's motion for summary judgment. That goes to the merits of the case. It's not like the other issues that are either jurisdictional or procedural. So I will go through those 4 issues with the court's permission, and beginning, as I must, with mootness, as it goes to the jurisdiction of this court.
Well, Mr. Mitchell, let me skip ahead for a second. If we agree with you on issues 1 through 3, why would we reach the motion for summary judgment?
The court wouldn't be required to reach that issue, Justice Kelly, but we would respectfully ask the court to reach it regardless for the sake of judicial economy. This case has been oscillating back and forth between the state Supreme Court and this court. This is now the second time we've appeared before this court on appeal, and we believe it would be more efficient for this court to weigh in on every one of these issues, even though Your Honor is correct to point out that if the court believes the other issue to be dispositive, it does not need to reach the merits of this case.
What of the pending certified question to the Supreme Court, which they could grant right now, you know, for all we know, how would that impact us ruling on the motion for summary judgment?
It's all going to depend on what the state Supreme Court says. I think it is possible, it's certainly possible, that the state Supreme Court would weigh in on how the Texas Religious Freedom Restoration Act applies to these type of claims. Judge Umphress, in that case that Your Honor just mentioned, is asserting a similar claim. He's not relying on state law, he's relying on First Amendment federal law, but the Fifth Circuit asked the state Supreme Court to weigh in on these state law questions. But I don't think it necessarily requires the state Supreme Court to rule on the Texas RFRA issue. We certainly hope they will, and for full disclosure, I'm representing Judge Umphress in that proceeding. So we will be asking the state Supreme Court to rule on the Texas RFRA questions, but it might find a way to dispose of the certified question without. So there's no guarantee that the state Supreme Court will rule on it. I don't think this court, I recommend the court not wait, although I do think it's possible and very likely the state Supreme Court may rule before this court does. But I don't believe it requires this court to postpone its analysis for the state Supreme Court, unless the court intends to reach the merits on summary judgment. You know, obviously, the state Supreme Court's not going to say anything about the res judicata or collateral estoppel issues, nor will it say anything about the other issues we've raised, apart from the merits of the Texas RFRA claim. So that's a somewhat long-winded answer to Your Honor's question, but I think the long and short of it is very possible Umphress will be relevant once the state Supreme Court rules, and obviously if the state Supreme Court does rule, we'll notify the court right away and provide our analysis. So again, Justice Kelly, I'm going to get back to your earlier question about why rule on all four of them. And I was suggesting judicial economy. I also think the state Supreme Court is very likely to hear this case again, no matter how this court decides this. I think it's very likely the losing side, whether it's us or whether it's the commission, is going to seek further review in the state Supreme Court. And they will benefit, I think, from a thoughtful analysis of the issues from this court, however the court decides the case. It's always helpful to an appellate court to have a reasoned decision from the lower court to review when it's being asked to resolve those issues. And I think the last point that I would make, Justice Kelly, is that Judge Hensley has now been litigating this case for 5.5 years. And she's losing income to the tune of $10,000 per year because she still cannot resume performing marriages given the threats that the commission has been imposing over her current practices. So even if the court disagrees with Judge Hensley's claims, We do believe it's important that she get a ruling one way or the other. She's entitled to know what the law is without further undue delay. And it's not just for her, it's for every single judge and justice of the peace in this state.
Have you conferred with your opposing counsel on that issue about whether or not this court should consider the MSJ?
We have certainly briefed the issue. I've not spoken to Justice Lange in a meet and confer sense about how this court should weigh in on it. I don't understand. I certainly know he opposes our motion for summary judgment. I don't know what his position actually is on whether this court should reach the issue if it rejects the other arguments that we're making.
Ordinarily, we wouldn't consider it because it wasn't considered by the trial court.
That's true.
I am interested in whether or not you two agree on whether or not we should consider it.
Yeah, I can't speak for Justice Lange, and again, I haven't discussed it with him. Your Honor is correct. The district court did not rule or didn't even deny our motion for summary judgment because it disposed of the case both on plea to the jurisdiction and on the plea to the estoppel. So it did not reach the issue. I guess for this court, it wouldn't be reviewing the district court decision, but it would be directing something on remand, either directing entry of judgment against us or directing entry of judgment in our favor. And I understand that's somewhat unusual. An appellate court typically reviews decisions that have been made rather than getting ahead of the trial court to tell the trial court what to do on those issues. But you know, if you look at Justice Blacklock's concurrence in Hensley, he seemed to think that ruling was warranted because there are no disputed issues of fact. If there were, certainly it should go back to the district court because the appellate court should not be resolving disputed factual questions. These are pure questions of law. So I don't believe there really is much benefit, Justice Crump, to having the district court weigh in on this matter in the first instance because, in our view, there are no disputed issues of material fact, and one side or the other is entitled to judgment on the matter of law. We obviously think it's us, but if the court disagrees, we would respectfully ask the court just to say so and direct entry of judgment for the commission.
Thank you.
If you believe that. So if I could turn to mootness, because again, we have to deal with jurisdiction before we can get to these other issues in the case. Jurisdiction always comes first. The commission is making two different arguments. They're saying first that Judge Hensley's claims have been mooted by what the state Supreme Court said in the Hensley opinion. And they're also saying that Judge Hensley's claims are mooted because they unilaterally pulled down the public warning after the state Supreme Court ruled. Neither moots the claims that Judge Hensley's making in this case. Number one, Judge Hensley is seeking damages. And as I understand the commission's position, they are not arguing that the claims for damages have become moot. And if I'm wrong, Justice Lange should correct me, but they are only claiming, as we understand their argument, that it is the claims for declaratory and injunctive relief that have been mooted.
Well, even to that point, mm-hmm. if there are outstanding issues of damages, wouldn't the trial court need to consider those damages? And those are questions of fact, correct?
The amount of damages that we've suffered are questions of fact, but damages are capped at $10,000. And there's no question that Judge Hensley has lost at least $10,000 of income, and we provided that evidence in our summary judgment motion. But you're, I think Your Honor's right. If the damages were continuing to grow as the case progressed, that would require a remand. But because of the statutory cap at $10,000, I don't think there's anything left for the district court to do on the amount of damages. But certainly on the mootness issue, the claims for damages remain live. I don't understand the commission to be disputing us on that point. What they are arguing, however, is that our claims for prospective relief have become moot. They're wrong on that, however, because for numerous reasons. Number one, voluntary cessation does not moot a case. And this is a textbook example of voluntary cessation. We sued. 5 years after we sued, they changed their behavior by pulling down the public warning. That is not going to moot a claim for declaratory or injunctive relief in any jurisdiction, not in federal court, not in state court. The second reason is we're not challenging the public warning. We are not asking for relief to undo the public warning. In fact, we've conceded that we can't seek relief from this court or any court to undo the public warning that was issued, because the only way to vacate that is taking an appeal to the Special Court of Review from the commission, which we did not do.
But the public warning doesn't exist anymore.
It no longer exists. But we were not asking for relief to wipe out the public warning as a remedy. We never asked that at any point in this proceeding. So they can't really say that the relief we're seeking is moot, because we never sought that type of relief in the first place. What we're asking for is an injunction and a declaratory judgment telling the commission that in the future, if Judge Hensley decides to recuse herself from same-sex weddings, she can't be disciplined for that. That claim remains live. And the fact that they pulled down the public warning that they previously issued doesn't affect our ability to ask this court for that relief. And again, this is distinct from the merits. We're not saying we're entitled to that. Well, we are, but that's a separate argument. All we're saying is it's still possible for the court to grant us that relief, and that's all we need to show in order to defeat their mootness claim. And the third reason this case is not moot is Judge Hensley is seeking fees under the UDJA, the Uniform Declaratory Judgment Act, and that is a discretionary determination. And the state Supreme Court has held in State against Harper that even if a case ordinarily would become moot, a litigant who is seeking attorney's fees under the UDJA can continue to litigate those claims, because the court will need to resolve the fees question ancillary to their judgment on the merits. State against Harper. Now, the rule's different in federal court. In federal court, if a case becomes moot, you can't say, oh, I'm trying to seek attorney's fees, and use that to stave off the mootness argument. But the state law of Texas on mootness is different from the rules that apply as the U.S. Supreme Court has interpreted Article 3. So three separate and distinct reasons for why, even on the issues of prospective relief, Judge Hensley's claims are not moot, which allows this court to reach the remaining questions, the plea and estoppel, and all the other issues that the district court ruled upon. So I'm only going to spend a few brief moments on ripeness and advisory opinion, if I could. We're seeking damages, so it's obviously ripe. I mean, a claim for damages is never going to be unripe. And again, we're not seeking an advisory opinion because we're seeking damages. So that alone defeats the idea that we're somehow seeking something that's outside the proper purview of a state court. And then also, you know, the commission has been trying to say there's currently no threatened disciplinary actions being directed toward Judge Hensley. And they're trying to say because of that our claims aren't ripe. Well, of course there's currently no threatened actions, because Judge Hensley has stopped doing weddings entirely in response to what the commission did. That doesn't show that the claims are unripe. What that shows is that she has, because of the commission's threats, changed her behavior, and she's coming to court for relief so she can know whether she can resume performing marriages or not without fear of discipline. That is certainly a ripe claim, and we certainly have standing to seek pre-enforcement relief. It's a textbook example of why pre-enforcement judicial review exists in the first place. We don't force litigants into a situation where they have to defy the law first and take the risk that a court might reject their constitutional arguments, and then if they guess wrong, they have to face the penalties for that. We allow them to come to court first to seek a pre-enforcement decision from the judiciary on whether they're allowed to do what they want to do and what they believe to be legal. So I'll move on to the plea and estoppel, which is somewhat more complicated. Two different issues here. There's res judicata, and there's also collateral estoppel. Judge Hensley appeared before an agency, not before a court, to defend herself when the agency was seeking to sanction her back in 2019 over her behavior. And the agency issued a ruling against her, as the court well knows. Normally, res judicata or collateral estoppel apply when there is a judicial decision. This is an agency decision. Sometimes agency decisions can have preclusive effect, but only in limited circumstances. And the test comes from a case called Utah Construction and Mining, which we discuss in our brief. And there are three factors that have to be met for an agency decision to have either res judicata or collateral estoppel effect. Number one, the agency must be acting in a judicial capacity. Number two, the agency must make a finding of fact. They have to resolve a disputed issue of fact that is properly before it. And then number three, the parties must have had an adequate opportunity to litigate the disputed issues before that agency. Let's start with whether the agency is acting in a judicial capacity. That's not the case here. We have a statute from the legislature that specifically says that the State Commission on Judicial Conduct does not have the powers or the authority of a court. So that statute by itself precludes any claim that they were acting in a judicial capacity. Number two, they were not acting in a judicial capacity because they were not resolving a dispute between adverse parties. There was no other party appearing before the commission prosecuting or bringing a grievance or a complaint against Judge Hensley. It was just the commission itself imposing disciplinary sanctions on its own initiative. They weren't acting in a judicial capacity. They were acting in their own unilateral disciplinary capacity. And then secondly, the commission didn't resolve any disputed issues of fact that were properly before it. There are no disputes over the fact. Judge Hensley recuses herself from performing same-sex marriages. Everyone agrees about that. The facts are not in dispute. The law is in dispute. The question is she legally permitted to do that under the Texas Religious Freedom Restoration Act? The commission disagrees with us on that point. We believe the answer is yes. They think the answer is no. But the commission did not resolve a disputed question of fact, and even if it did, those questions have nothing to do with what we are arguing in this court. We're seeking a ruling on a pure question of law.
Is the commission's conclusion that her actions cast doubt upon the sanctity of the judiciary, is that a conclusion of law?
It is a conclusion of law, yes. Fact? Yes, because what they're saying is that there's a compelling governmental interest, in their view, of protecting the integrity of the judiciary and protecting against any possible appearance of impartiality. And our response to that is, again, an issue of law, which is there is nothing to be, it does not in any way undermine the impartiality of the judiciary for a judge or a judicial officer to express disapproval about a particular type of sexual behavior. That does not necessarily evince hostility toward people who are litigants who appear before them in this court. There's a very important distinction to be drawn between bias and animus toward a person and criticism or disapproval of a certain type of behavior. Almost all judges who are running for office are going to say, may I finish the sentence? I see my red light is on.
Yes.
Judges who run for office will often express disapproval of criminal acts or pedophilia, murder, rape, all those things. That doesn't mean they're going to be biased against criminal defendants who appear before them who are accused of engaging in that conduct. The simple fact that a judge expresses disapproval of a type of behavior does not mean they're going to be biased against a person who engages in that behavior when that person appears before them in court, either in a criminal or civil capacity.
But just go ahead, sir.
Yes.
Excuse me. I was just going to say, following along that analogy, though, it would be if a judge refused to hear murder cases rather than being biased while hearing the cases. In this situation, we have someone who's just not doing the same-sex marriages.
Yeah, I guess you're right. How does this analogy carry over? Because you can't really recuse yourself in your non, so she's not acting as a judge. She's acting as a wedding officiant, and she's recusing herself from certain type of marriages that are, number one, outside the definition of marriage in Texas statutes, but number two, contrary to her religious beliefs. So how can you really analogize that to a judge who may, perhaps on the campaign trail, say, I'm opposed to murder, I'm opposed to rape, I'm opposed to pedophilia, or whatever other acts the judge may express disapproval of.
But all those things are also illegal.
They are illegal, that's correct. That's correct. But same-sex marriage under the law of Texas, again, the statutes, is illegal. Because Texas has not...
Are you making the argument here that all same-sex marriages in Texas are illegal because they violate state statutes?
I think Judge Hensley would have a much harder case if the Texas legislature specifically defined marriage to include marriage between people of the same sex. I'm not saying it would be impossible. But Judge Hensley is acting in a manner consistent with Texas statutes. Now, I understand Obergefell comes in and says the statutes are unconstitutional. That's the ruling of the Supreme Court of the United States. But that cannot change the definition of marriage in Texas law. What Obergefell holds is that if a state official...
We don't have to retread Obergefell.
I think
we're good there.
I'm not fighting a rearguard action against Obergefell. I'm just trying to say the scope of that holding does not redefine marriage under Texas law. And if a state has changed its statutes, this is an important distinction, because interracial marriage, I think, would present a very different question. Because number one, Texas does not ban interracial marriage in its statutes, but more importantly, Texas's anti-discrimination provision.
I think we're getting way far afield of this last issue from your analysis.
It goes to compelling interest. Your Honor, that's what I just wanted to say. Texas has specifically banned wedding officiants from discriminating based on the race of the couple. And that shows the compelling interest to distinguish that from this situation here.
I have a question that you didn't quite get to, but in terms of trying to understand what our task will be here at the third court, can you direct the court to where the ultra vires claims were when they were at the district court and the second amended petition? I don't see any specific allegations about what the commissioners did.
We did mention an ultra-virus claim in our second amended petition. And unfortunately, I don't have the pin site in front of me. I can get that
on
the bottle.
I did, because I was curious about it, and
And he also may have a few moments before rebuttal to be able to pull that up.
And I'm sorry, I know I'm past my time. Is it okay if I answer this, Your Honor? Different courts have different rules on this.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to.
If you look to paragraph 74 of the second amended petition, that's where she sets forth her ultra-virus claims, and she directs the court to paragraph 67 through 73. And I just don't see in those paragraphs, at the time that they were before Judge Schoyfer, the trial judge, where there are any specific allegations about what the commissioners did or how they acted outside of their ministerial duties. And so I'm just trying to understand what we are being asked to do here with respect to the ultra-virus claim.
Well, our claim, Your Honor, is that the commission and the commissioners are violating Texas RFRA and thereby acting beyond their statutory authority. So we mention ultra-virus because we're suing the commissioners, and that's the only way we can get around immunity when you name an official as a defendant in one of these situations.
Right.
And we're seeking only prospective relief on ultra-virus. Can't seek damages. That's only available under Texas RFRA. So it's a hook to provide the claim for declaratory and injunctive relief against the individual officers. So the ultra-virus...
Well, I understand why you made it, but where is the substance of those actual claims?
Oh, it's all through our petition, where we say they violated Texas RFRA, where we say they violated the state constitution. Those are the violations of state law that make the actions ultra-virus. Really, the threat. It's the threat of discipline that's ultra-virus, because you're seeking to enjoin future actions. We can't use ultra-virus to go back against what happened in the past. So we specify ultra-virus as a basis for our cause of action, but the rationale for our ultra-virus claim is all throughout this petition. Every time we say they're violating state law, that's an accusation that the commissioners are violating Texas RFRA and thereby acting ultra-virus by the threats of future discipline they're imposing on Judge Hensley.
But is there any precedence that would allow us to consider prospective actions of individual commissioners to actually substantiate an ultra-virus claim?
My understanding is that that is what an ultra-virus claim is. It's trying to enjoin future unlawful acts, because sovereign immunity prevents you from seeking retrospective relief against the commission or against the officers who are members of the commission. All we can do is seek prospective forward-looking relief to enjoin a future or anticipated violation of state law or state statutes.
But that falls under the UDJA claim.
It also does. But the UDJA claim is what we use to sue the commission, because we have to rely on the UDJA waiver of sovereign immunity there.
Right.
With respect to the commissioners, we don't need a waiver of sovereign immunity because it falls within the ultra-virus doctrine, similar to Ex parte Young doctrine in federal court. The courts just say this doesn't even implicate sovereign immunity because the officer is stripped of his sovereign capacity when he's acting in an unlawful manner in the future. So that's what we're trying to do. And I'm sorry if I wasn't completely spelled out in the petition, but every time we talk in the petition about violations of state law, we're describing the ultra-virus claim that we're bringing against the commissioners, as well as the UDJA claim that we're bringing against the commission itself.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And Mr. Lang will certainly give you some additional time if you need it.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that. Thank you for having us here for argument, and my esteemed opponent here. May it please the court. Yes, we did get a little far afield, but that's kind of a function of their claims, which are difficult to understand. I would like to put some context to this, if the court please, because I don't think it's as broad and deep as has been suggested.
First, the public warning. It was about what she said. It's clear that this court, the first time around, wrote down exactly what the public warning said. And it found that she allowed herself to be, interviewed, you call it, by the local newspaper, radio, TV. And they asked her, what's going on? And she said, well, I don't believe that Obergefell was decided correctly. I don't believe in gay marriage. I'm opposed to the gay lifestyle. And she went on. And I'm just simply not going to conduct marriage ceremonies for gay couples, but I will for heterosexual couples. So it's what she said that demonstrates her bias. And she doesn't have to pick somebody out of a crowd and say, I think you're one of the people I've been talking about. It's what she presents. And you know what the Supreme Court said in the very first paragraph of that opinion that brought us back here? And I'm going to quote part of it. Quote, and while they may have rights to hold and express personal views outside their judicial duties, their extrajudicial actions must not cast reasonable doubt on their capacity to be equally fair at all. She was wearing the mantle of a judge, and she has a right, an opportunity, a power to conduct wedding ceremonies. So one can't say she's not acting as a judge. I mean, if she were acting as someone ordained in her church, might be a different story, but she's not. This was a judge speaking out, and that is what started this whole thing. So it was her voluntary statements that really brought the attention of this matter up.
So Mr. Lang,
go ahead.
Mr. Lang, now that the commission has withdrawn its public reprimand, what of of Mr. Mitchell's argument that this isn't moot because the commission could always come after her in another time? And Chief Justice Hecht, in his opinion, noted, bless you, that the makeup of the Judicial Conduct Commission, you know, is different than it was before. It stands today, it's different than it was even when he wrote that opinion. So who's to say what the Judicial Conduct Commission will do in the future with this conduct? And therefore, that makes this not moot.
Well, first of all, this commission that presented the public statement said very clearly, there's nobody left that was here in 2019 when this public warning was decided. Nobody. We've reviewed everything. It's quite clear. We know what the Supreme Court said, that it's going to go back for the TRIFRA claim, at least. So we've reviewed everything, and we've just said, let's stop this. We are going to say it's over with. This public warning is no longer in effect. We're taking it off the website. And for the appellant to say, we never tried to disturb that public warning, is just kind of double talk. As Justice Lehrman said in her dissent, you know, what's the difference here? They clearly are trying to disturb that. That's the whole basis for their lawsuit. The TRIFRA substantial burden was the public warning. They can't get away from that. Now, you know, they asked the commission to rule on their TRIFRA defense. That wasn't plucked out of the air somewhere. They came up with several defenses. They raised them. The commission deliberated and said, this is what we're going to do. We're going to give you a public warning for what you said, not because you marry particular people. It's what you presented to the public to demonstrate your bias. And as the Supreme Court said, gosh, you can't get away with that. You just simply can't do that. You know, in the Minnesota versus White case, it's very interesting how that court dealt with this issue. And they said at page 889, I'll just quote a little bit. I know how it is. You've read so much getting ready. But they said at page 889, courts in our systems elaborate principles of law in the course of resolving disputes. The power and prerogative to perform this function rests in the end upon the respect accorded to its judgment. The citizen's respect for judgment depends in turn upon the issuing court's absolute probity. Judicial integrity is in consequence a state interest of the highest order. That's what the Supreme Court said we were to do. The Supreme Court made the rules. The Supreme Court said, you will hear issues about discipline of judges. They did, and the issues were raised, and T. Riffer was one. So they decided, it wasn't our decision, at the commission, they decided they would forego the route that the Supreme Court set up for them to appeal a decision. And that is, give notice to the Chief Justice that you want to go to a special court of review for a de novo trial.
But hasn't the Supreme Court already rejected that path, right? I mean, our court issued an opinion right in line with you. The exhaustion of remedies has been rejected.
I apologize for getting kind of excited about that. But what I wanted to point out is that's where we've gone. And to say that there was no decision that is in effect, and thereby not having an estoppel effect or res judicata effect, simply disregards the system that was set up.
What of Mr. Mitchell's argument that, you know, these doctrines don't apply because, you know, the commission wasn't acting in a judicial capacity? There was only one party, and it's not an adjudication, and the government code says the commission, quote, does not have the power or the authority of a court in this state.
With respect to my learned friend, I think he's wrong about that. You know, there is some case law that says it's not a court. It doesn't adjudicate in that manner. But what does it do? It adjudicates the defenses that are raised by any given judge. And that's precisely what was done. And then they hopped over that course that the Supreme Court said they could and went to this court. Now, the withdrawal of that opinion is something, decision is something I want to talk about for a minute, if I may, about the mootness. The case law is significant in this state about mootness. And the exception that the appellant would raise is this voluntary cessation issue. Well, this court has ruled on a situation like that. The 14th court has ruled twice on a situation like that. And the Fifth Court of Appeals in Dallas has also ruled on that. In the city, State versus City of Austin, as you may recall, I'll quickly go through this because I know you've read it, but I think it's important to emphasize it. City of Austin had an order that you're going to close down during COVID over the New Year's holiday. You're going to close down bars and restaurants. The state came in and said, you can't do that. Well, after New Year's came and went, the city said, this is moot. And the state said, they could do it again. But this court said, no, you have to show a reasonable prospect that they're going to do it again. And there's no reason to think that that is the case. Secondly, you've got, and they said, the resolution depends on the occurrence of contingent future events that may not occur as anticipated or may not occur at all. Texas Funding versus Harris County, 14th Court decision. It was a situation where the county judge for Harris County said, during COVID, we're not going to have foreclosure sales this next month. And as you know, there's a statutory date when foreclosure sales to take place. So Texas Funding comes in and says, stop that. You can't keep us from foreclosing. That day came and went. Texas Funding says, I want this court to please decide they can't do this again. The 14th Court made it very clear whether or when is a whole different issue. And it's speculative. Same kind of thinking as this court. Then there's Robinson versus Alief, ISD. In that case, Mr. Robinson was a former employee of the Independent School District, and he said, I want, in my lawsuit, I want the ISD to expunge certain things from my personnel record about my past conduct. Well, they argued for a while, and the ISD said, we'll do it, we'll expunge it. He said, that's not enough. I want a prospective injunction and mandatory order of this court that says they can't go back in and revive that language in there. And that court said, there is no present or continuing present injury or reasonable expectation, that's key in both these cases, that AISD will reinstate the expunged documents. Robinson's request is merely conjectural and hypothetical. And indeed, that court finished by saying, Texas courts are not vested with the authority to render advisory opinions. And then there's the Turlock versus City of Duncanville case from the Fifth Court, 2009. In that case, Mr. Turlock was actually tried on a public obscenity matter. I won't go into it, it's not worth it. But he was tried, he was going to be tried. So he tried to stop that by saying the ordinance was unconstitutional, violated his rights of free speech. The city said, tell you what I'll do, I'm going to amend that ordinance. And they did. And it was a little different, and it remedied some of the issues that Mr. Turlock raised. He said, once again, I want an injunction. I don't want them going back and reinstating this ordinance. That's not right. And the court said, there's this prospective relief is mere speculation. We don't know what's going to happen. We don't know what it's going to look like, even if they were to do this. And the court said this, there is ample time to obtain judicial review should the new prosecution occur under this old statute. So what they're saying is, don't deal with this now because it's all speculation.
But what of her claims for damages, you know, these other things that are not resolved by the commission's withdrawing of the order? Her TRIFRA claim for $10,000?
What, as we're all aware, the Supreme Court said, that's going back. TRIFRA claim is there. She's got the burden to show substantial burden. This public warning, which they say they were attacking, substantial burden on her religious beliefs. Well, there's a cap of $10,000, as we know, but she's got that burden. There are fact issues there. There's also the defense by the state to show that there was substantial reason to do this, and there was really no other way to get about it. This 4A was what the Supreme Court told the commission to enforce. So they have to make that decision.
Mr. Lang, if I could for a moment here, if we don't agree with you on the mootness or the unripeness or on the plea and estoppel, what's your position on the motion for summary judgment? Is that something that you believe we should decide, or is that something that you believe that should be decided by the district court, since it did not make it never reached that point in the the decision tree?
Well, interestingly, there was argument. I wasn't there because I didn't handle the trial part, but there's a reporter's record that was part of the argument made, as well as the other things. But the commission objected to what the appellant submitted as their evidence. She said it's a substantial burden. That's all she said. There were no facts to support it. That was it. We objected on the conclusory nature of that. No evidence. Also, the $10,000. I've lost $10,000.
Did she rule on any of the objections?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
No, those are outstanding at this point. If I may, I'm sorry, I didn't want to cut you off if you had another question, because I had another point I'd like to address.
Well, I think we're just left with whether or not the commission and the commissioners wish for this court to consider the MSJ or not.
I think it needs to be determined by the trial court.
Okay.
I mean, as my learned friend pointed out, this may not be our last stop or the trial court, which is too bad. There are ways to handle things, and that's what Justice Young said in his concurrence. He didn't agree with now Chief Justice Blacklock on a lot of the things he said, and certainly Justice Lerman didn't agree. But I think what we're looking at is we know there's going to be a T River claim tried, and we want our day in court. Just like they've been saying, they want their day in court. And based on our objections, I think they're good. Now, whether they come up with anything that substantiates those conclusory statements is a whole different deal. Now, yes, ma'am.
Well, then what is it specifically that you and your clients believe that this court should be deciding? And it's not terribly clear from anything that we have before us. So I just want to make sure that I'll ask your esteemed co-counsel as well.
Right.
Yes, I will absolutely indulge you in more time. Yes.
Thank you.
What needs to be decided, we believe, is the mootness issue. And as I pointed out, what they're claiming is, I want prospective relief, even though I know now that they withdrew that public warning, and they, just because I believe they could reimpose it, I want that relief now. It's like these other cases. That's speculation. We don't know what, if anything, she might do. It's as the rules and other opinions out of the Special Court of Review show, it's all dependent on the facts. So we don't know what she's going to do, if anything. And so that is moot. And she also asked for a very broad, all-encompassing declaratory judgment and prospective injunction as to all Texas judges. Seemingly, if any of them are doing what she did, we want the commission barred from investigating them or bringing any action against them. Not only is that speculative, she has no standing. Standing is clearly, you have to show an individual, personal injury to get that kind of all-encompassing injunctive relief. It just isn't in the cards for this case or any case, because our Supreme Court and other courts have opined on that again. They are not there, those other people. They're free to do whatever they want, but we can't prejudge them, and we can't be asked to prejudge them, because the commission, under Article 5, Section 1A, G, and all the subsections, the job is to investigate and proceed, if appropriate, to discipline judges. And we are told by the Supreme Court of Texas what the rules are, and the rules are the canons. So we're to apply that law, Canon 4A, which is clear in its language, and the Supreme Court even spoke to that on the way back here. So we would request this court to determine that prospective relief for anybody, they don't have a class action, they've said that, there's no jurisdiction for it, they can't do it. Secondly, for her, the question is moot, and it's speculative. So we're asking for those two things essentially, and also to go back and look at all the other things that she raised. This court said, in the first opinion, there were three requests for declaratory judgment injunctive relief that were asserted, were dismissed by the trial court, but they weren't raised here. And I won't read those to you, but it's in that opinion. 1, 2, 3. And the Supreme Court, at footnote 70, I believe, said, yep, I agree with the Court of Appeals. They're gone. Then the Supreme Court said, well, as to the freedom of speech claim that the action of the commission violated freedom of speech, they're insulated from that. They're immune. But because there was an ultra-virus claim asserted against the commissioners, none of whom were still on the commission, then they have their day in court to try to prove that there was an abuse of their discretion. And the court, of course, did articulate it's not absolute discretion, it's limited, but that's a matter of proof. That's a matter for Judge Soifer to decide, just like the substantial burden, the $10,000 damage, and the affirmative defense of the commission. So I hope I've answered your question, Your Honor, but I didn't. Okay. I know we're all limited, and sometimes we get excited and want to talk and talk, but it probably is sufficient at this time, and I appreciate your having us here and listening, and whatever other points that I may not have touched on specifically that's in our briefing, I would rely on the briefs.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you have any other questions? No. Okay. All right. Mr. Mitchell?
Thank you, Your Honors. Let me begin, if I can, with mootness. There doesn't appear to be any disagreement that Judge Hensley's claims for damages remain live. That doesn't mean she should necessarily win on the merits of those claims, but they're not moot. It's possible for the court to grant relief. That's the test for mootness. It's possible for the court to grant damages. And nothing that the state Supreme Court did in Hensley, and nothing that the commission has done since that ruling, has deprived the court of the ability to award damages to Judge Hensley if it concludes that she is entitled to them. So let me move on to the second part of mootness, which is the prospective relief issues. Right. The commission still refuses to disclaim the possibility of future discipline against Judge Hensley or any other judicial officer who recuses themselves from same-sex marriage, even while they are revoking the public warning that they have previously issued.
But is in the commission in the business of making public statements about who they might and might not discipline and for those actions? I mean, do they put on their website, we will not be seeking, you know, we will not be seeking disciplinary actions against for these types of actions? and put that out into the universe?
They're not in the business of doing that, Your Honor, and they normally would not be doing that type of thing. But because they previously have disciplined a judge for this type of behavior, she cannot possibly have the assurance needed to resume the performance of weddings until she has either a ruling from a court about whether this is legal or some form of commitment from the commission that they won't.
In your view, what vehicle or what method would that commitment have to take to satisfy, to make the controversy moot?
I don't think there's anything, actually. Okay. I'm not saying that to be difficult, Your Honor. It's because it would still be an act of voluntary cessation, and that would still not be sufficient to moot the case. But may I answer a somewhat different question that I think will get to what Your Honor is asking at? Let's suppose Judge Hensley had never sued. What would the commission need to do to prevent her from having standing if she were to sue and seek relief? It would have to be some type of ironclad, resolute statement from the commission that said, even though we've done this in the past, we're not doing this again. Now, I understand the commission's membership could change in the future, which might raise a question of whether she would have a legitimate fear of discipline. But on the question of standing to bring a new lawsuit, I think a statement to that effect would foreclose a judicial case or controversy. The problem here is Judge Hensley sued at a time when they were disciplining judges for this behavior.
What of the standing argument that while maybe she could sit in the shoes, you know, and ask for an injunction to prevent her from being disciplined, what gives her the ability to be able to request for that sort of relief for other judges all across the state?
She shouldn't have that ability unless she's seeking a certified class, which we're not doing. So the only relief she should get from a state district judge would be an injunction limited to her. Now, if an appellate court rules in her favor, Your Honor, that would have statewide effect because of stare decisis, not because the judiciary would be issuing a universal remedy or something akin to a nationwide injunction, which is very much a hotly contested issue these days. But we agree with the general premise. Litigants can seek relief to protect themselves. If they want to seek relief to protect others, they need to have either a certified class or some other form of representative standing, which we don't have here. But that doesn't really go to mootness. I know Justice Lange mentions this. I don't see how that affects the mootness inquiry. Right?
Well, going then directly to this, that's your ultra-virus claim,
yes,
again, and your petition, which I think we all have a copy of. What you said earlier, can you provide more specificity as to a place in your second amended petition where we should look for the allegation of what the ultra-virus conduct is, other than you just said generically,
yeah,
they violated TRIFRA. Is there, because, you know, in the section on ultra-virus, it says, okay, well, we're seeking the same declaratory relief for these earlier,
yes,
paragraphs, which don't, you know, which are just acting for declaratory relief, and this injunction that will affect all judges, but it doesn't say, and our conduct is based on, you know, paragraphs 1 through 5 or 10 through 12. So what's the conduct that should we look to other paragraphs if you don't identify them in your pleading? And two, what are those paragraphs that we look to that will give us that answer?
Well, it says, I mean, I'm just looking at the complaint right now, where Judge Hensley seeks, and it's under the heading ultra-virus claims, is on page 17 of the second amended petition. But it says Judge Hensley seeks the same declaratory relief described in paragraphs 67 to 73 against each of the commissioners,
right,
in their official capacity. Right, so this is incorporating by reference everything in the previous section on declaratory relief.
Right, but it doesn't make a comment as to what was the ultra-virus conduct in those paragraphs. It says, you know, it talks about what your declaratory relief is.
Right,
and there's some statements about, well, you know, the commission's interpretation calls into question whether a judge may openly affiliate, but it doesn't say the commissioners. Also, let me make sure I've got the commissioners acted ultra vires by allowing the commission to make this statement. Or so, how much do we have to interpret to get there? Is my question.
I don't think it's a big interpretive leap, and you're right, Your Honor. It is worded differently in the declaratory. And may I continue?
Yes.
It is worded differently in the declaratory judgment section because a declaratory judgment needs to be phrased in terms of the rights and legal relations of the litigant who's seeking declaratory relief. So a declaratory judgment should say Judge Hensley has the following rights, and then list them. Right, the right to, and what we ask for is the right to officiate at weddings without having to perform same-sex weddings if it conflicts with their religious beliefs. When it comes to ultra-virus, you're looking to an unlawful act of an individual state official that might occur in the future, either because they're currently doing it, or because it's threatened, or because it's likely to occur. So when Judge Hensley is saying, I have a right to do this in the declaratory judgment section, the Ultra-Virus Act is the commission is disciplining her or threatening to discipline her for those very acts that she has the right to do. I don't see that as a big interpretive leap. And if we haven't pleaded this correctly, the rules of pleading are very generous. Notice pleading is the rule in state court, just as it is in federal court. General allegations are assumed to include the specific facts needed to get there. And the commission has never suggested until today, this is the first time that I've heard this complaint, that our complaint was somehow insufficient to put them on notice of what our ultra-virus claims were. And at this point, they've waived this because they have not sought to dismiss our complaint on that ground. Maybe they intend to do that if we get back to the district court, because they filed a plea to the jurisdiction that was granted. I don't know if that's their intention, but I don't think it's appropriate for this court to weigh in on that issue of pleading when, again, it was never raised in the district court, certainly hasn't been ruled on in the district court. And if they do want to make this claim, they can do it on remand.
I'm just asking for, in looking at your issues, to help identify exactly what the ultra-virus claims are.
So the ultra-virus claims are that the commission is threatening Judge Hensley with future discipline if she performs marriages.
Or could threaten her with future discipline, since they haven't, at this stage in the proceeding.
At this stage, maybe that is the right way to phrase it, but at the time we wrote this complaint, she was under threat. Okay. And yes, they did pull the public warning down, but that's not good enough to moot the case because, for all the reasons we said, it's voluntary cessation, and we still have the issue of attorney's fees under the UDJA, which, you know, that per se cannot moot a claim, simply because of the fact we're seeking a fee shifting under the UDJA. So, I mean, too many obstacles here for the commission's mootness argument. Many separate independent reasons for why the argument fails, and Justice Lange discussed some of them, but he did not come close to overcoming all of them in his remarks today. I'm happy to answer any other questions the court may have.
Do you have any questions? I don't have any remaining questions. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. This case is submitted, and you're excused.